I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Summer is winding down, and sadly, that means an end to Tell Me More's Summer Blend Book Club. All summer long, we've been digging into characters and stories that reflect upon the experience of being mixed race or mixed ethnicity. In a few minutes, author Heidi Durow, who started the series with us and in fact launched the Mixed Roots Summer Film and Literary Festival, is going to come back one more time to close things out. But first, to the final book in our series, Susan Strait's most recent novel, Take One Candle, Light a Room. The story centers on Fantine, who grew up in a tiny rural community of mixed-race families in California. As an adult, Fantine is a jet-setting travel writer who's created a life far away from the drugs and violence that plague other members of her family. But when Fantine's godson gets into trouble, she decides to go back home and face her past. Susan Strait joins us now from NPR Studios in Culver City to talk about it. Susan Strait, welcome. Thanks so much for joining us. Congratulations on the book, by the way, and all the awards that you've received.
Oh, thank you so much. It's always fun to talk about a novel.
Well, the opening of your novel sets the tone for the rest of the story. It's actually a very punch-in-the-gut opening, if I can, you know, put it that way. It describes a photo from 1958, five girls who are about to get into a truck and drive across country. For those who haven't read the book, could you briefly lay out the scene for us?
Yeah, that was a really hard scene to write. It took a long time, but I had this vision of this Apache truck. These five young women have to flee their tiny town in Louisiana in the 1950s because of a serial rapist. I mean, this is a man who feels that because these five young women are of mixed race, that their only use to him might be sex. And he's already targeted three girls. So these five remaining young women are taken onto an Apache truck, and they're driven to the bus station, and they are sent to California. The photo of those five women is sitting next to a photo of their daughters. These women have five daughters, and as you said, two get caught up in drugs and bad men, and two marry young and have kids. And Fantine's the only one who leaves. She's the only one that leaves that orange grove where they settled, and she keeps that photo kind of as a talisman to remind her of where her people came from.
You know, I want to say that right at the beginning that this opened something up for me, because when I was an adult, I was told the story. My father told me that when she was a girl, his mother was hidden in the root cellar of their home to protect her from precisely this kind of scenario. That's why that side of the family came north. And I was very curious about this because all of a sudden it seems to me that we're hearing more stories about this. For example, we're hearing about Rosa Parks' history as an investigator of sex crimes against black women that were never prosecuted. And I'm wondering, you know, how did this scenario come to you?
It's that strange combination for someone like me who's lived in the same place her whole life. I mean, I lived three blocks from where I was born, and I met my future husband in the eighth grade. There are all these family stories and legends passed down. When I was about 18, we were at this really large family gathering in the park. And someone said, well, how did you all get to California? And I heard someone behind me tell this story. Well, I had this beautiful daughter, and one weekend, Mr. So-and-so was said that he was going to come get her. And so we had to pack up in the middle of the night, and we came out to stay with our cousins. And I've heard variations on this story so many times that that's how people got to California. Mm. And you think, well, that must have happened in 1910 or 1920. That happened in 1950. The combination, I think, of that story and then having my own three daughters, from the time they were very small, you know, people would comment on their hair or their skin tone. And I had one very chilling moment where someone said to me, well, that one's so pretty, she'll never have to work. And there was this really weird sexual undertone. And she was 10. I think the combination of all those three stories led me to that scene.
And just to clarify for those who may not be absolutely sure what we're talking about in terms of your own personal story, you have three mixed-race daughters. You're white, your ex-husband, their father is African-American, but your families are still very close, and you've been part of that family for more than 30 years. And so what aspect of that do you think pulled through for you? Is it the fear of not being able to protect your girls? All of it, I guess.
When my husband and I were watching these three girls, and he still comes over every day. He spent 2 hours at my house yesterday, and we talked about this very subject, is that even though they're grown now, he still feels immensely helpless to protect them, not just because of their looks, but because of the way society has always looked at women who look a certain way. But that story of being hidden in the root cellar, to me, that's iconic. And that's, I think, the primal fear when you have any daughter is, how will I protect her? And somehow, to me, that translated to walking down the hallway at night, looking at these three girls and also thinking, well, what will they do in the world and how will people judge them? And there's this huge historical difference in America between looking as if you're Samoan or Hawaiian or Algerian and saying, I'm black. And so that's something that my daughters and I talked about all of their growing up, because people mistake them for everything.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. It's the final book in our Summer Blend Book Club, and we're speaking to author Susan Strait about her latest novel. It's called Take One Candle, Light a Room. Going back to the novel, as we mentioned, it centers on Fantine, who is racially ambiguous in appearance. Like you were saying, like with your daughters, people constantly mistake her for or are curious about her heritage. She uses that ambiguous racial identity kind of like a passport, right?
That's exactly the way I thought about it, yeah.
What do you think you're saying about this, though? Do you feel that you're saying that, in fact, color is dispositive in ways that people don't want to admit? What do you think you're saying here?
I was thinking that only someone like Fantine, who wants to reject, in a sense, where she came from, might do something like this now. And I was thinking that Fantine is this modern-day version of someone who's not passing but reinventing herself. And it's the opposite of what my kids do. I mean, my kids always say, no, I'm black or I'm mixed. Fantine uses it just as you said. It's kind of like this weird passport because she feels so ambiguous about coming from a rural settlement in Southern California. In the end, that's been kind of her downfall, because when she rejects who she is, she's really rejecting her parents and she's rejecting her siblings. But she's also really lonely. I think Fantine is that kind of person that we say, like, there are two kinds of people in the world, those who stay and those who leave. Mm-hmm. And Fantine always knew she was going to leave.
Well, she's not just rejecting culture. You know, it's not just a choice of eating crayfish versus, you know, something else, right? It's also a lot of pathology and bad stuff, and that she just doesn't want to be part of until she gets drawn into it in a way that family often draws you into things. And when you talk about that choice of sort of staying or going, what are your thoughts about how this perhaps reflects on the experience of African Americans who are not racially ambiguous, but who have choices by dint of education or experience that, you know, perhaps their relatives don't have, who are deciding, do I want to get involved in Cousin Boo Boo's problems or not, you know?
When my daughter, my oldest daughter, who just graduated from college and has to decide whether to stay or leave, and she's going to leave for Texas on Saturday because she can't find a job here. And those are exactly the things you're talking about. When she started this book, she said she didn't like Fantine very much in the beginning, and then she understood her more. And in this family, it's a betrayal to leave. And so Fantine also not just is trying to be more upwardly mobile as far as living in Los Angeles, but also enjoying this utter and complete independence. I don't want to have to speak to anyone if I don't want to. And that kind of a betrayal for a family like hers is something I was really interested in reading about, because it's something you don't often read about. What do you owe your community, right, Michelle? I mean, that's really what we're saying. Hmm. What do you owe your family? And then that's an individual choice for Fantine.
And I think it is a story that will resonate with many people, whether they are of this background or not. If you want to hear an excerpt from this story, please go to our website, go to npr.org, click on the programs tab, and then on Tell Me More, and we'll ask Susan to read an excerpt from the piece. Before we let you go, I do want to ask a little bit about the dialect. The Fantine's parents speak in a mix of kind of Creole and English. Fantine's cousins use language that a lot of people will really kind of think of as kind of contemporary of the hip-hop generation. Part of the reason this is interesting to me, I'll just be honest with you, is that you'll know right now as we are speaking, Catherine Stockett's book, The Help, has been made into a film, kind of polarizing. Some people feel that it's patronizing. They think her story is ridiculous. And the dialect is kind of a flashpoint. The Association of Black Women Historians wrote a scathing critique of The Help, but they highlight previous book of yours, A Million Nightingales, what they consider to be a more accurate portrayal of black characters. And I'm interested in your reaction to all of that. First, the use of dialogue, as I said, and then this whole question about what's okay and what's not okay.
All you have to do is listen and be absolutely sure that you know your characters. And I didn't read The Help, so I can't weigh in on that. But when I was in graduate school, I studied with James Baldwin. I was really lucky. And we talked for a long time about dialogue. The people that you're talking about in this novel were people that I grew up with. My in-laws lived on a street, and down the street were two families from Louisiana. And both of the men in those families didn't speak any English. They spoke mostly French. And so I think that combination of hearing it growing up and then also just wanting to say, I have nothing to do in the process of dialogue. I'm trying to make the reader feel as if he or she is right there in the conversation. And so I don't try to manipulate it too much. Do you know what I mean? Like, if someone's going to speak as if they're from my neighborhood and they're my age, I just turned 50, they're going to talk like Fantine and her friends. I mean, we use crazy words like hoopty for a car and things that came up when we were kids. But if someone's going to be an elderly black man like Fantine's dad, Enrique, he's going to speak in this very particular mix that I've heard all my life. And I try to replicate that on the page. Again, I can't weigh in on the help, but I think what I've always loved is to be the short, invisible woman who sits in the corner at every family reunion or on every, you know, occasion I can and listens to how people talk.
Susan Strait is the author, most recently, of Take One Candle, Light a Room. She's also a mother of three. She's a professor of creative writing at the University of California, Riverside, and she was kind enough to join us at our NPR studios in Culver City, California. Susan Strait, thank you so much for joining us.
This was such a pleasure.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Pat Summitt, the legendary coach of the University of Tennessee women's basketball team, has more wins than any coach in NCAA basketball history, male or female. She's led the Lady Vols since 1974. Over the last year, Pat Summitt noticed she was getting confused, more forgetful. She felt like she was drawing blanks. Well, now she's come forward to explain why. She recorded a video that's posted on the Lady Vols website.
Earlier this year, the doctors at the Mayo Clinic diagnosed me with an early onset dementia, Alzheimer's type, at the age of 59.
Pat Summitt decided to talk about that diagnosis with two reporters, one of them her close friend, Sally Jenkins, the Washington Post sports writer who co-authored Summitt's autobiography. Sally, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
How did Pat Summitt describe to you the signs that she noticed, the things that signaled to her that something was wrong?
Well, the main thing you notice is that she would ask two or three times, now, what time do I have to be there again? What time is my meeting? Or, I mean, even something as basic as practice. You know, what time is practice? Now, nobody loves practice more than Pat Summitt. She's always said she prefers practice to games because it's her classroom and that's where she teaches. So that was a pretty profound sign that there was something, you know, off.
When you watched her coaching in games, did you see at all a different Pat Summitt than you had seen before? Was it showing up
just
at
slightly?
The games?
You know, she was still so highly functional that it was a little confusing. But in the final game that the Lady Vols played, they lost to Notre Dame. And I thought in that game you could see that her assistants were really getting in the huddle and drawing up plays. And I sort of watched that and thought, you know, that Pat wasn't as confident. She had lost her confidence in terms of directing the team in the heat of a high-pressure game. And that was another, I think, fairly profound sign for me that she just wasn't grabbing onto things with her usual mental sharpness.
Hmm. Here's how you described the change in your story in the Washington Post this week. There's a faint sense of dimming as if a jar has been placed over a candle.
Well, Pat is incandescent. I think that anyone who's ever been around her, she radiates such energy. You know, she's a throwback, her head laugher. And there was just, in retrospect, a slight sense of something withdrawn and suppressed. And I think a lot of that is not necessarily the dementia. I think a good deal of that, I believe, was Pat becoming withdrawn because she was so worried about what was going on with her. And one of the things that I've been so glad to see in the last few days is that now that she has clarity and now that she has an answer and she sees the opponent, as her son says, I feel like Pat's more herself this past week than I've seen her in the past year, to be perfectly honest.
Hmm. Pat Summitt is famously tough and wouldn't have gotten where she is if she weren't intensely driven. How did she react at first to the Alzheimer's diagnosis?
Well, as her son Tyler says, nobody accepts this diagnosis. Denial is probably the normal reaction. And I think that there was a few weeks of, well, I'm just going to go on about my normal business. And she had a very busy schedule this summer. And so I don't think it was really until the end of July that she was able to really sit down. And I think her son Tyler really forced her to sit down and address this head on. You know, she had a big decision to make. She had to decide whether or not to continue coaching with this. And I think that she just needed, you know, 5 or 6 weeks to mull that over and internalize it and come to the realization that the quickest way to ruin her health would be to give up what she loves the most.
You write, Sally, that under Pat Summitt's contract, the University of Tennessee could have removed her as head coach, but they haven't. They've embraced her. Her role, though, is going to change. How's it going to change?
Well, they don't really know yet. She's sitting down with her staff and her athletic director. They're going over what Pat does really, really well. For instance, you know, Pat Summitt is one of the great rebounding coaches of all time. I mean, that hasn't gone away. That's still there. She's still one of the great defensive-minded coaches who ever, I think, ever lived, men or women. You know, that's still there. What she has difficulty doing is tracking all 10 players and both benches in the heat of a game. The day that she feels like she's a liability as opposed to an advantage, she'll walk away tomorrow. I mean, if she's said it 100 times, if she said it once, I don't want to hurt the program. I don't want to hurt the team. And, you know, if she thought for an instant that she would be some sort of liability, she wouldn't be in the building today.
I want to play a bit of tape. This is Pat Summitt telling you how she thought she was going to let her team know about this diagnosis. This is a video that's on the Washington Post website.
I'm just going to go in there and be myself and tell them what I've dealt with, and we're going to move on, and that's what I want them to do. I don't want them to be, there's no pity party, and I'll make sure of that.
That's my girl talking right there. That's Pat. You know, it's funny. Her players said that the meeting started out sort of subdued, and, you know, there was a gasp, a sharp intake of breath. But within about 15 minutes, it became, you know, you could hear laughter coming out of the room. I wasn't in the meeting, but there was this sudden turn towards a real upbeatness, and Pat used it as motivation, and her kids are using it as motivation. You know, they all came out of there with grins on their faces. You know, it's funny, but the people around Pat get real strength from her in this.
You know, Pat Summitt is such a high-profile figure in the sports world. Does she see herself now as having a public role, as sort of a face of Alzheimer's disease? I get the sense that she's also quite a private person.
First of all, yes, she does see herself as taking on a spokesperson role. If there's any way that anything she can do as a public figure might help stir up attention towards funding for research or provide an example for people that you don't have to just go home and go into a dark room and do a crossword puzzle. You can try to remain as highly functioning for as long as possible. You know, I think that one of the things you learn from Pat is that your attitude is a choice. She says it is what it is, but it will become what you make of it. Those are her battle cries, and it doesn't matter whether it's Alzheimer's or cancer or an ACL injury. She's prepared her whole professional life for this sort of battle. She has prepared her kids her whole professional life for this sort of battle. If this sort of thing isn't what she has been teaching basketball to young women for, then she's had no purpose at all these last 38 years.
Sally Jenkins, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's Washington Post sports writer Sally Jenkins talking about her friend, the Tennessee women's basketball coach Pat Summitt, who has been diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease at age 59. Summitt will be coaching her 38th season with the Lady Vols at the University of Tennessee.
Back in 2009, I set off on this road trip for NPR to mark President Obama's first 100 days in office. I wanted to hear personal stories about how communities were coping with the recession. Well, now more than 2 years have passed, and whatever else might have changed, the economy is still shaky. In the coming weeks, we'll be reaching out to some of the people I met 2 years ago. Today, we'll check in with a small company in Columbia, Kentucky called Majestic Yachts. They make houseboats. A man named Jim Hadley was running the company with two of his friends, and he told me how it's so much more than a job to them.
We are kind of like an old rock band. We've been together a long time, and hopefully we'll be together a whole lot longer. We love what we do. Manufacturing of houseboats and river yachts in our blood has always been in our blood.
At that time, February 2009, the orders for houseboats had dried up. There was no business, and Jim had to lay off all 27 of his employees. His factory floor was eerily empty. He wasn't even heating the place. I asked him to fire up a few of those machines just so I could hear them, and it brought a smile to his face.
We're going to fire it up here. Uses a lot of juice to get the cranking. Now we're getting back to my sound.
To be honest with you, David, that was probably the worst time of our careers, if not the worst time of our lives.
At the end there, that was Jim speaking to me by phone. I called him back to see how things are for him now. Tell me how the old rock band is doing.
The old rock band is hanging in there. We're pretty tough. We've saw a lot of our industry go by the wayside. But we've hung in there, David. We have did everything that's legal and moral to stay in business, from construction jobs to working on horse trailers, boats, repairs. So we're pretty tough, David. We've just gotten tough with the times.
And Jim, what do your experiences say about the economy?
David, back in February and March of 2011, our phones started ringing. We had customers, walk-in customers. It seemed like that the economy was starting to turn around. And then, as you know, the fuel prices started to go up, and it seemed like it just almost killed it instantly. However, with that said, the economy has come back a bit, not very much, but some. We've been able to recall 5 employees here.
One of the people Jim was able to bring back was a woman named Faye Womack. She used to work for him as a seamstress making seat cushions for those houseboats. Well, the demand for houseboats hasn't come back strong yet. For now, Faye is working as the company's receptionist.
Good morning, David.
Faye Womack, how are you doing? It's nice to hear your voice.
Thanks. It's nice being back.
Do you miss working on the boats and doing the seamstress work?
Yeah, because I love to do that.
Faye, I want to play a little bit of a conversation you and I had driving in your car. I hope that's okay with you, because it really stuck with me, you know, after I visited you.
I really hate because we're all laid off. It's bad because, you know, there's a lot of good people works there. Sad. It is really sad. You know, you hate to lose your job. And, you know, there's people with families and there's nowhere here to get a job.
Faye, I have to say, when I did that trip in 2009, your voice stuck with me like no other. What are your emotions now compared to then?
Not quite as bad. I wish everybody was back. It would be better. But I think that things will get better. You know, there's people comes in and out, and they'll price a boat, and then they'll think about it. But the thing is the economy's so bad, and, you know, people just don't want to make those big financial decisions right now.
You told me when we were standing out there at a marina that you were worried back in 2009 that the houseboat industry might never come back. You still have that fear that industry is just never going to get back on its feet?
I don't know. It just depends on the economy because, you know, a lot of the houseboat companies have completely closed. I mean, they're gone. And we're one of the very few that's still around. So I feel like that if we can hang in there long enough that in time it will, but it may be, you know, a few years down the road.
That's Faye Womack. She is an employee at Majestic Yachts in Columbia, Kentucky. Faye, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you, David.
We were also talking to Jim Hadley, who is the owner of Majestic Yachts. Jim, thank you for your time.
David, certainly good to hear from you, and thank you, David.
We're going now to Wake County, North Carolina. The 800 square mile area includes Raleigh and its suburbs, and the school district there has been embroiled in a 2-year fight over how it assigns students. It's a fight that has led to protests and arrests and cries of school resegregation. Well, in the middle of this heated debate, a new school is opening this week. It's a school many in Wake County and across the country are going to watch closely. Dave DeWitt of North Carolina Public Radio takes us there.
Hey, kindergarten team, how are y'all?
Great.
Y'all having lunch today?
Corey Moore is the principal we all wish we could have had. He's got experience, charisma,
And as he practically skips down the hallway just a few days before he opens a brand new school, all the enthusiasm in the world.
It's been amazing seeing some of the classes just develop and come to life and all the color. And I get excited every time I walk down the hallway.
Walnut Creek Elementary in Southeast Raleigh has the latest in classroom electronic blackboards and networked computer labs. It has hand-picked teachers, small classes, and a longer school day. It's also the latest battleground in an ongoing fight that has split the community. For 10 years in Wake County, students were assigned so that no school would have more than 40% low-income students. To achieve this, suburban kids chose magnet schools downtown, while mostly poor kids in Southeast Raleigh were sent to schools in the suburbs. On the night last year when he voted to end that policy, school board member John Tedesco said it was flawed.
I think now it's time we start educating those children instead of hiding them and shuffling them. That's the deal. I don't think we've done a good job of educating them. We have to close the achievement gap, so now it's time to educate those children, not just shuffle them and hide them.
Supporters of the diversity policy staged protests. The school system nearly lost its accreditation and is now the subject of a civil rights investigation by the U.S. Education Department. During a meeting last summer, as police led away several people, Board Chair Ron Margiotta read a statement to try to calm fears.
This board does not intend to create high poverty or low-performing schools in the new zone assignments.
A year later, Walnut Creek Elementary is holding its first open house.
Attention all parents and families. We'd like for you to go ahead and move into our multipurpose room at this time. It is 5 o'clock.
The students here are mostly high poverty and low-performing. Exactly the kind of school the school board chair said would not be created. The Reverend William Barber is the president of the North Carolina NAACP.
Why would you create a school that's high poverty, racially identifiable, resegregated, when you know that the law is against that? Your goal should be diverse schools with resources. Why not do what had worked in Wake County before?
Barber, legal experts, and educators across the country are watching Walnut Creek to see if extra resources will make a difference for low-income students. And parents are paying attention, too. Paula Wordsworth's son, William, is starting second grade at Walnut Creek.
I think folks are going to watch to see if the kids are at a level that's competitive with the other kids in Wake County. I'm optimistic. I think that the parents here are eager and willing to participate to ensure that the kids rise to the highest expectation.
Wordsworth says she's especially encouraged by the principal. Corey Moore says he refuses to believe his school is set up to fail.
If I believed that, then I wouldn't have accepted the job here. We have children just like any other school in the world. They are children who come to school. They want to learn. They want to grow. And they depend on us.
The fight over schools in Wake County enters another round in October. On Election Day, 4 seats and control of the school board are up for grabs. For NPR News, I'm Dave DeWitt in Raleigh, North Carolina.
As we said earlier, our Summer Blend book series has taken us deep into the experience of the emerging story of mixed-race Americans. We decided to end where we began with a conversation with author Heidi Durow. She is the author of the bestseller, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. She co-founded the Mixed Roots Film and Literary Festival, and she helped us kick off our series back in June. And she joins us once again from NPR West. Heidi, welcome back. Thanks so much for joining us, and thank you for helping us with the series.
Thanks for having me back.
Now, you read all the books that were featured in the series, and in fact, you featured some of them at the festival. Did you see any themes threaded through all of these very different stories?
They were all very different, but I was struck by some certain patterns that were going on. The first thing was when we started this off at the beginning of the summer, we talked about this trope of the tragic mulatto. These old stories about the mixed-race person who couldn't find a home in either community and died tragically of consumption or some awful disease, right? But in these books, I was so struck by the fact that they're funny. There's so much humor in these books. I found myself laughing out loud so often when here I was reading books about the mixed experience. And aren't they supposed to be serious and teach us something? Well, they're teaching us something through humor also, which was really exciting to discover.
You know, the thing is, I think it's sometimes hard to remember that it was not so long ago when multiracial families weren't just hidden, that they were actually illegal in many states, that the Supreme Court didn't outlaw discrimination. Well, rather, let me just put it this way, that the Supreme Court decision in the case of Loving v. Virginia was in 1967, and until that time, there were still 16 states that outlawed mixed-race marriages. And I wonder, Is it remarkable that there has been this change in attitude in such a short period of time, or do you feel that perhaps we should be farther along?
I think right now we're in such an interesting place because we are finally talking about it. We have a long way to go still, and I think where we're going to find our answers really is through the literature, through the stories that we start telling about these experiences. One of the other things that I realized as I was reading these books again is that we're actually talking about being multi-generationally mixed. There's this talk now suddenly about the ways in which we continue to be mixed, and we reinvent mixedness with each generation.
Well, I think it's important to point out that we've always been mixed. We just didn't admit it. But to that end, according to the census, mixed-race people still make up a very small percentage of the American family. Maybe it's hard to contemplate that, but really, according to the latest figures from the census, it's just over 2% of the population.
It's not very much, is it, when you talk about those hard numbers? But what that number doesn't really show is who those people are related to. When I've gone around and I've talked about the girl who fell from the sky, what I'm so interested in is when I meet someone who I think is a quote-unquote white person, someone who has blonde hair and blue eyes and pale skin, and they'll say, this is about my family because my sister is married to someone from Tanzania. And the census number doesn't reflect the fact that we love people in so many different ways. It doesn't show us who we love, and it doesn't show necessarily who might be interested in knowing more about this experience.
And finally, before we let you go, I'm going to put you on the spot, which is such a terrible thing to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm sure that maybe even 5 years ago, many people would never have envisioned that a person of mixed ancestry, our president, would be leading the country, even though he personally self-identifies as black, as African-American. But he is of mixed race ancestry, obviously. And I'm wondering, 5 years from now, how do you think our national conversation around race and the mixed race experience might have evolved?
I think what's happening is that the people who feel like they're outside of this conversation, that it's something that other people have to deal with. And very honestly, by this I mean mostly white people, that when we start talking about race, there is this coded language. And I think these books, these stories about the mixed experience, once again offer, especially people who are part of the majority, permission, gives them an entree to say, I actually am part of this story too. So can I talk to you about this? There's this way in which we don't want to be offensive, right, when we're talking about race, but we also want to talk about it. We just need a way in. And I think a story is the best way to do that.
Heidi Durow is the author of the bestseller, The Girl Who Fell from the Sky. She's also the co-founder of the Mixed Roots Film and Literary Festival. She's been helping us with our Summer Blend book series, and she was kind enough to join us from the studios of NPR West. Heidi Durow, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
If you want to hear our previous conversations or all of our conversation in our Summer Blend book series, just go to our website, go to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and then on Tell Me More. And that's our program for today. Tell Me More is produced by Bridget Deshagas, Monica Evstatieva, Eamon Malone, Sanaz Meshkinpour, Amitha Parasher, Kathleen Schuster, Amy Ta, Sarah Ventry, Malik Washington, and Saran Yitbarek. Our editor is Alicia Montgomery. She had a hand this week from Lori Grant. Our directors this week were Arjun Hutchins and Emily Oxenschlager. Our senior producer is Devar Ardalan. The technical director is Brian Jarbo. He had a hand this week from Neil Tevolt and Kevin Waite. Our theme music was composed by Underdog Entertainment with additional arrangements by Ian Honeyman. The supervising senior editor is Portia Robertson-Migas. The executive producer is Tashima Walker. To tell us more, please go to npr.org and find us under the Programs tab. You can also friend me on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at TellMeMoreNPR. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Let's talk more tomorrow.